Welcome back, everyone, to another deep dive here. Today, we're going to be looking at a really interesting area of Fourth Amendment law, something that I think any law student, anyone who's interested in criminal procedure really finds kind of fascinating. And, you know, it's the whole question of warrantless vehicle searches, right? So specifically, what happens when that car isn't actually going anywhere, right? It's not, you know, driving off, speeding away. And to really kind of dig into this, we're going to be focusing on a very specific case from 1982, the Supreme Court case of Michigan v. Thomas. And, you know, I think what we're really going to try to unpack here is how this ruling, this Michigan v. Thomas ruling, really helps us understand when exactly police can search a vehicle. And this is even after it's been impounded, you know, taken into custody, if you will. So we're going to be diving into those nuances, sort of the intricacies of this automobile exception to the warrant requirement.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the automobile exception in general is just, it's so interesting, right? And I think, you know, what we're going to try to do today is go even beyond just the outcome of this case. Like, sure, we'll talk about what the Supreme Court ultimately decided, but we want to really understand, you know, how does this case fit into this broader idea of the Fourth Amendment? We're going to be looking at this seemingly contradictory idea that you can have a warrantless search and it can still be justified even when the vehicle isn't moving. I mean, think about that. That whole idea of mobility is so central to the automobile exception. But here we have a situation where that's no longer really an issue, right? The car is impounded. And yet, you know, we see how probable cause still matters. It maintains its relevance, even in that context. That, I think, is something that a lot of people find really surprising when they first learn about it.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's one of those things that, you know, the more you think about it, the more questions you have, right?
Yeah.
So let's kind of take it back, right? Let's rewind back to 1982, set the stage. What exactly led to this, you know, pretty landmark case? What were the circumstances?
Okay. So it all starts with something that, you know, at first glance seems pretty routine, right? Just an ordinary traffic stop. You have police officers who pulled over this car. And the reason, you know, the stated reason was that the driver failed to signal a left turn. Inside the car, we have Thomas, who's sitting in the front passenger seat. And the person driving, you know, behind the wheel is a 14-year-old. So, you know, a simple traffic violation in theory, but things escalate pretty quickly from there.
Yeah. So we start with this very minor infraction. What was it exactly that, you know, drew the officer's attention? What made this more than just a routine stop?
Well, as the officers are walking up to the car, right, they're approaching it. They notice Thomas, the passenger, and he's making this really noticeable bending motion, right? Almost like he's trying to hide something under the dashboard or, you know, conceal something down there. And then on top of that, they see in plain view an open container, right? An open container of malt liquor. And it's on the floor of the car, right there near Thomas's feet.
Right, right. Okay. So we've got open intoxicants.
Yeah.
That's obviously a violation right there. So what happened next? What did the officers do at that point?
So because of the open container, they arrest Thomas. And to make matters even, you know, more complicated, it turns out this 14-year-old driver, well, he doesn't have a valid driver's license. He's not supposed to be driving, you know.
Yeah.
And when they ask Thomas about the car, you know, who owns it, Thomas says, "Hey, it's mine. It's my car."
Oh, okay. So now not only do you have this situation with the open container and the arrest, but you also have an unlicensed driver behind the wheel, and the person claiming to be the owner is now under arrest. So I'm assuming the police decided to impound the car, right? I mean, that seems like standard procedure in a lot of cases.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, you can't just leave a vehicle like that, you know, just sitting there on the side of the road, especially when it's unregistered, no licensed driver to take control of it. So yeah, the officers decide to impound the car. That's what they do.
Makes sense. So the car's impounded. What happens next? What kind of search are we talking about here?
So the first thing that happens is one of the officers, he conducts what's called an inventory search. And, you know, this is pretty common practice, really. Whenever a vehicle's impounded, the police often do this inventory search. They go through the car, document the belongings that are inside. It's partly for safekeeping, you know, making sure those belongings are protected. But it's also to protect the police department, right? If something goes missing from the car, they want to be able to say, "Hey, look, we documented everything." They're trying to avoid any kind of liability, right, for lost or stolen items. So during this inventory search, this officer opens the glove compartment and it's unlocked. And inside, he finds two bags of marijuana.
Okay, so marijuana found during a standard inventory search. Now, this is a really important point, right? Because this inventory search, legally speaking, it has a very specific basis.
Yeah.
It's different from, say, a search that's based on, you know, some suspicion of a crime, right? Those are two different things.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. An inventory search is not about investigating a crime per se. It's administrative. It's about, you know, making a record of what's in the car, safekeeping those items, and protecting the police department. But here's the thing. Finding that marijuana, well, that changes things, right? Because now the officers have something else. They have probable cause. They have a reason to believe that, hey, maybe there's more contraband in this vehicle. So based on that, a second officer, he decides to do a more thorough search. He's going to really take a closer look at the car.
And this second search, this more extensive search, that's what becomes the real heart of the legal issue, right?
Yeah.
What exactly did this second officer do? What was he looking at?
Yeah. So this officer, he goes beyond just the glove compartment, right? He's looking under the seats, he's looking around the dashboard area, even checked the trunk. And importantly, the trunk is locked, so he doesn't actually get into the trunk. But he's really kind of looking everywhere he can. And then here's the key moment. He's checking these air vents, right? They're located underneath the dashboard. And hidden behind those air vents, he finds a loaded .38 caliber revolver.
Wow, okay. So now we've gone from marijuana, which is, you know, one level of offense, to a concealed weapon, which is obviously a much more serious situation.
Yeah.
So what happened next? I assume Thomas was convicted on, you know, the gun charge, but I also imagine he didn't just let that stand, right? He appealed.
Yeah, you're exactly right. So Thomas is convicted, but he argues that the way the police found that gun was illegal, that it violated his Fourth Amendment rights, you know, that whole protection against unreasonable searches and seizures. His main argument is that searching those air vents, that was unreasonable. They didn't have a warrant to do that. The car was already impounded. It wasn't going anywhere. And there wasn't any kind of immediate danger, right? There weren't what we call exigent circumstances that would justify searching the car without a warrant at that point. So he's saying, look, they needed a warrant to do that, and they didn't have one.
And what did the court think about that argument? Did they agree with Thomas?
Well, the Michigan Court of Appeals, they did agree with Thomas. They overturned the trial court's ruling, and they said, yeah, this air vent search, that was unreasonable. Specifically, they said it was too broad, right? Unreasonable in scope is how they put it. It went too far, especially considering the car was already impounded. It was in a secure location under police control. So they're basically saying, look, once the car is impounded, that urgency, that need to search it without a warrant, that goes away. The exigency that might have justified a warrantless search at the scene, that's gone now.
Right. So the Michigan Court of Appeals, they're focused on this lack of exigent circumstances, right?
Yeah.
Once the car is impounded, it's not like it's going anywhere. So they're saying the police should have gotten a warrant. Which leads us to the big question that the Supreme Court had to decide, right? What was the specific legal issue that the Supreme Court took on in this case?
Yeah, the Supreme Court had to grapple with a really fundamental question about this whole idea of the automobile exception. They were trying to figure out, okay, let's say the police have probable cause to search a car, right? They develop that probable cause during a lawful stop, but then the car gets impounded. Does that probable cause, that justification for searching the car without a warrant, does that just automatically disappear once the car is impounded and under police control? Like, is that the end of the story?
Right, right. Okay, so that's the issue. Probable cause versus impoundment. So what did the Supreme Court decide? Which way did they go on this?
Well, the Supreme Court, they end up reversing the Michigan Court of Appeals. They sided with the state. They said that Thomas's conviction, it stands. They said that the gun was legally obtained. But to understand why they ruled that way, you got to look back at some earlier Supreme Court cases that they relied on in their decision. These cases, they really lay the groundwork for what the court did in Michigan v. Thomas.
Okay, so let's talk about those precedents. Which Supreme Court cases were really important here? What were they building on when they decided this case?
The two big ones are Chambers v. Maromi, that's from 1970, and Texas v. White from 1975. And these cases, they set out this really important principle, this core idea within the automobile exception. And the principle is this. If the police have probable cause to believe that a car has evidence of a crime in it, and they develop that probable cause during a lawful stop, then they can search that car without a warrant, even if they don't search it right away, even if they take the car to the police station first, even if it's been impounded. The court in Thomas was basically saying, hey, this principle, it still applies here.
So even though the car is not moving, the fact that they have probable cause earlier during that initial lawful encounter, that's enough to justify a later search, even when the car's, you know, sitting in an impound lot.
Exactly. It doesn't just suddenly become off limits because it's not mobile anymore.
Yeah.
And that brings up a really interesting point, right? I mean, if you think about it, one of the big reasons we have this automobile exception in the first place is because cars can be moved, right? Mm-hmm. Evidence can be driven away. But here, the car's not going anywhere. So, you know, it's natural to wonder, does that mean the automobile exception shouldn't apply?
Yeah, it does seem kind of contradictory, right? If the whole point of the exception is mobility and the car's not mobile anymore, then why should the exception still apply? I mean, that's something that a lot of our listeners, especially the law students out there, I'm sure they're thinking about that right now. It's a really good question.
It's a great question. And the Supreme Court, they directly address that in their decision. They say, look, just because the car isn't moving, that doesn't mean the justification for a warrantless search goes away. They say the right to search based on probable cause, that's immediate. It's not like they have to wait and get a warrant and then come back and search the car. They can search it right then and there if they have probable cause. And importantly, they say this right to search, it doesn't depend on some later determination by a judge, right? Like, the police don't have to wait for a judge to say, oh yeah, you know, it was good that you searched the car without a warrant because, you know, it could have been moved or the evidence could have been tampered with. The court's trying to make this a clear rule, you know, not something that depends on all these specific facts of the case. They're saying, look, if there's probable cause, that's enough.
So it all hinges on that initial probable cause, not on whether the car might have been moved or evidence tampered with later on. It's about that moment when the police first have that reasonable belief, right?
That's right. And the court is really trying to avoid a situation where, you know, you have to go back and analyze every single little detail after the fact. They want to make this rule as clear as possible based on what the police knew at the time.
Okay, that makes sense. So let's go back to the specifics of Thomas's case. We had that initial stop, the open container, the arrest, the impoundment, the inventory search where they find the marijuana, and then the more thorough search that leads to the gun. I'm curious, how did that discovery of the marijuana during that inventory search, how did that play into the Supreme Court's decision about the gun?
This is a really important point. The Supreme Court, they pointed out that the Michigan Court of Appeals, they had already said that the initial inventory search, the one where they found the marijuana, that was legal. They didn't have a problem with that.
So they were okay with the police looking in the glove compartment. It was the search after that, the more extensive search, that they took issue with.
Exactly. And the Supreme Court said, well, if that initial inventory search was legal and they found marijuana, then that gives them probable cause to keep searching the car.
Right. Finding that marijuana created a new reason, a new probable cause, to believe that there might be more contraband somewhere else in the vehicle.
Yeah.
So the Supreme Court said that the search that led to the gun, that was justified. It wasn't just an extension of the inventory search. It was a separate search based on this new probable cause that they developed when they found the marijuana.
Oh, I see. So it's like a chain reaction, right? The legal inventory search led to the discovery of marijuana, which then gave them a justification to keep searching, and that's how they found the gun. That connection is really important.
You got it. And that's a key takeaway from this case. The gun wasn't found during the inventory search itself. It was found during a separate search, a more extensive search, that was justified by what they found during that initial legal inventory search. Okay, so let's kind of bring it all together, right? What are the really big principles that come out of Michigan v. Thomas? What are the things that our listeners, especially those who are really diving into this area of law, what should they take away from this case?
I'd say the main point is this. If the police have probable cause to search a car, that's the deciding factor. If they develop that probable cause during a lawful encounter, you know, like a lawful traffic stop, then they don't need a warrant to search the car. And it doesn't matter if the car gets impounded later on. That impoundment, it doesn't negate that probable cause, that justification that they already had. Or, like we talked about, if they develop probable cause during a lawful inventory search, then they can do a more extensive search based on that.
And the Supreme Court's not going to get into second-guessing whether there were still exigent circumstances once that initial probable cause existed, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're not going to say, well, you know, maybe the car wasn't really in danger of being driven away, so you should have gotten a warrant anyway.
Exactly. Once the police have that probable cause, the courts aren't going to nitpick and say, well, was there still an emergency? Was the evidence really at risk? The focus is on whether they had that probable cause at some point.
Got it. So I'm thinking about how this affects defendants, right?
Mm-hmm.
If someone's car is searched after it's been impounded and they want to challenge that search, what does this ruling mean for them? What kind of arguments are they going to have a hard time making now?
It definitely makes things more difficult for defendants in those situations. If the prosecution can show that the police had probable cause to search the car at some point, then the defendant can't just say, well, they searched it after it was impounded, so it's illegal. That argument's not going to fly. And, you know, even if they argue that the search went too far, that it was too broad, well, if the police can tie that search to the probable cause they had, then that argument probably won't work either. But, and this is important, all of this depends on the police doing things by the book in the first place. That initial stop has to be lawful. And if they do an inventory search, that has to be legal too. If the police mess up on those initial steps, then the defendant might still be able to challenge the evidence.
Right. So even though this ruling gives the police more leeway in some ways, it doesn't give them a free pass to do whatever they want. They still have to follow the rule.
Exactly. It all goes back to that balance, right? Balancing the need for law enforcement to do their job with protecting people's rights.
Okay, so just to kind of sum it all up, the big takeaway from Michigan v. Thomas is that once the police have probable cause to search a car, they have that authority. And they don't lose that authority just because the car is impounded.
Right. That probable cause, it sticks with them. And this case really highlights just how broad the automobile exception can be.
And, you know, it makes me think about something. Given how much authority this case gives to the police, do you think this could lead to more cars being impounded? Like, even for minor offenses, could police be more likely to impound a car just so they have the opportunity to search it more thoroughly later on? Maybe they're hoping we'll find something during an inventory search that gives them probable cause to really dig in. It's something to think about, right? How these legal rulings can have real-world consequences that go beyond the specific facts of the case.
Absolutely. And it's something that, you know, anyone who's studying law, anyone who's interested in criminal justice, they should be thinking about. What are the unintended consequences of these decisions? How do they play out in practice? It's a really important discussion to have.
I agree. Well, that about wraps up our deep dive into Michigan v. Thomas. Hopefully everyone listening has a better understanding of this really important case and how it affects warrantless vehicle searches. And as always, we encourage everyone to keep thinking about these issues, keep asking questions, keep learning. Thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.